Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Community Geek Podcast. Member Spotlight, we're here talking with David Adams.
Hi, everybody.
All right, so let's get started here. What first drew you to online communities? And tell me a little bit about your first one.
I suppose, like a lot of people, I was sort of a user, a consumer of online communities from pretty early days, I guess, from back before, before the web, really. So CompuServe, dial-up bulletin boards, all that kind of stuff back in the kind of, early 80s. And then through that, onto Usenet and news groups online. So that was in the early days, generally just following whatever my interests of the time were. And then I suppose I got more sort of seriously interested in them in the kind of late 90s and early 2000s, looking at again mostly sort of following my interests. And which are technical for with regard to work, and then other fun stuff. one of the first ones that I got involved with professionally was a pilot's forum, because aviation is an interest of mine. And I signed up as a member, and I noticed they were forever having technical problems with hosting and so on, and I was running a company, as I still do, which as one of its kind of secondary services offers hosting to our clients. Usually we host stuff that we've built and developed for the client, but sometimes we do hosting for just pure hosting. And this was in the days before cloud hosting and before kind of the commoditized market of virtual service for $20 a month kind of thing. So I contacted the owners of the site, and they were amenable to being helped, because they needed help. So started off with them. That was a forum called Prune, the Professional Pilots Rumor Network. And that went pretty well. It was a vBulletin system that we hosted, and we did a bit of work on the back end, but mostly it was a hosting exercise. And they were eventually brought out by internet brands in the US. But that was the first one, I suppose, that I really got into the depths of, and that was more than 10 years ago now.
Do you actually fly? Are you like an experienced pilot, or just a hobby?
Yeah. Only, not professionally, but personally, not so much these days. I've got a young son, and the time associated with flying is not too compatible with young children generally. Mm. So, there's a lot of waiting around and, driving to and from places, that kind of thing. So not so much these days, but I used to fly quite a lot, in Europe and in the US as well. Just for fun, and the internet and indeed online communities are a great resource for that kind of thing, because hooking up with like-minded souls is obviously a big deal, but also kind of connecting with people in different parts of the world who might be able to actually meet up with when you're in that part of the world flying or otherwise. So some of the best kind of friendships I have relating to aviation have been formed through various online communities.
That's terrific. Now, you've been at this quite a while, and I would have to say that it shows in your posting, because I would have to give you the distinction of probably being the single best poster in all of Community Geek. Like, every thread that you're is a treasure trove.
Well, that's very kind. Thank you. I suppose it's mostly born of experience. I've worked with, as I say, Prune, which was a pretty big and busy forum in the early days. These days, my biggest sort of community exposure, if you like, is with Mumsnet, the UK parenting forum. I know you guys have spoken to the community managers there.
Mm-hmm.
So you did an interview with them, which was great. I've been involved with them pretty much since they started. So that was about 11 or 12 years ago, I think now. And we've always done their hosting and various technology sort of development and consultation, both on a sort of commercial level and on a technical level. And a lot of my experience with regard to community management and the kind of things that are discussed on Community Geek, a lot of it comes from experience with Mumsnet. I've worked very closely with them over the years, and so I've sort of seen the growth of them from a forum where, it's the kind of forum where you're just trying to generate some traffic. You're getting ringing up your friends and asking them to ask questions on your forum so that you can generate some interesting conversation, right through to what they are now, which is, as you know, a pretty big and successful online community, which is mostly revolves around their talk boards.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
I've had a lot of experience with them, but also, in more recent years, I've been involved with another aviation undertaking, which is a European general aviation website called EuroGA, and that for general aviation. That was an interesting one because I started that with a guy completely from scratch. There's plenty of piloting forums around, but he wanted to start a new one that was a bit more focused. And we did it, and it was a really interesting exercise because we did sort of start from scratch, but with a very specific sort of set of goals, if you like. And it was interesting to see how we built that up. Because I think one of the most interesting things I think about communities in the early days, certainly, is that, the most fundamental sort of basic network effect, the need for, nobody wants to be the only person in a particular community.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, how did you get those first core members?
Well, it varies a lot. In that case, he was a fairly prolific writer of information about the trips that he'd been on, and he had quite an address book of people, and he sent me a pretty rough and ready kind of email list, and we did some work on parsing that down and eliminating duplicates and so on, and then he mail shotted the remainder. That got that one started. Oftentimes we find clients come to us and say, we want to start a community from scratch, and we usually recommend that whilst the community part of a site, in particular a discussion forum part of the site, is invariably one of the most valuable aspects of the site, because it's for a publisher, it's great. You get lots of page views, you get lots of user generated content, you get people coming back day after day, which they're not going to do for just static content. So community and forum content is brilliant, but we find that it's very, very difficult to get a community started without having something else to draw people in, either a product or a service or a collection of information, published articles, a successful blog, just something that people will come for the other thing, but they stay for your forums. Starting a forum from scratch when you have nothing is really hard. As I say, we did do it with EuroGA, but we did it on the basis of this guy's mail, on this guy's sort of personal address book kind of thing. But another thing that I find really interesting is that actually you can have a pretty successful, pretty vibrant, thriving community with relatively few people. I think people look at some of the big communities and think, wow, they're so enormous. I could never achieve that level of sort of vibrance. But actually, when you look, even some pretty big, successful, vibrant communities actually have relatively few active, really active members. If you have a community with 100 people who visit the site kind of pretty regularly, and maybe 25, 50 of them posting regularly, that can turn into a pretty vibrant community.
Now, if only we had their numbers. Community Geek just passed the 50 member mark last week, actually.
Right. Okay. So, and you know, like I said, it's a successful community and becoming more vibrant by the day. You know, so you don't need. I mean, I think Community Geek is somewhat unusual. Obviously, it's a paid for community, one doesn't tend to come across a huge number of those, but within this sort of space. But I think that you can have relatively few people and make a success of a community. So, you know, getting started is tricky because, as I said, nobody wants to be the only one. It's like, you know, nobody wants to be the only person in the world with a fax machine, which used to be the analogy. Now nobody has fax machines, so nobody cares. But you don't want to turn up at a forum and see, you know, 20 different topics with two posts in each topic, which is actually a mistake that we see clients making quite often. They have an over proliferation of topics into which they categorize their posts, which is generally a mistake, I think. You're much better off starting with a single topic, getting some traction there, and then splitting it up into multiple topics, as the site grows.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about DSC Limited. You said this is your company now. Were you a founder? You've been with them for over nearly 25 years, not over, but
yeah, no, I founded the company back in, I think it was, I'll tell you a funny story. Recently I got it in my head. It was the 25 year anniversary. And so of the company being formed, cause it was formed in the late 80s. So I thought, well, we were going to do a kind of couple of promotional things. We were going to pick a couple of clients, who had been sort of, you know, with us for a long time. And we were going to do a sort of promotional piece of work for them that they wanted and that we would then be able to kind of publicize that we'd done this work. And maybe it was something that would have a real measurable impact and we could kind of promote that. So we thought we would do it as part of a kind of 25 year splash. So I announced this to the client and we started working on it with them. And it was about 3 months into the project, I realized then that we were actually only 23 years old rather than 25 years old. So we carried on and we finished the work and we haven't publicized it yet. I think we'll probably sit on it for a little bit longer and then maybe publicize it going into our 25th year perhaps. So yeah, been around for a while. Company started off. Day one, it was just me. And then back at, over the sort of early 90s, it was just me. And then, so working really as a consultant for other people. And then, in the late 90s, started, you know, taking on more projects and more staff. And we've sort of ebbed and flowed since then. We had a lot of projects that were underway. Funnily enough, given the date, we had a lot of projects that were underway that then got cancelled after September 11th back in the day. So we contracted quite a bit after that because a lot of our clients were banking clients that we were building online web software for. And a lot of those projects went away. So it was actually our hosting business that kind of kept us going after that, because most of the new development stuff dried up for a while. But then we sort of came through that, and now are doing more and more in the sort of online community arena.
Yeah, I don't feel bad about forgetting your founding date and stuff. That actually happened to me quite recently on my own podcast. I got interviewed.
Oh, really?
I got interviewed. And I was like, how long have you been doing this? And I blanked. It's like, how long have I been doing this? Was it 2008? 2009? No, it couldn't have been 2008. That's too early.
Well, I wouldn't have minded if I'd just, you know, forgotten it on the spur of the moment, or my maths was off on the spur of the moment. But this went on for about 3 months before it dawned on me that actually it wasn't. I think I actually looked it up at the in the UK, the official sort of registry of companies called Companies House. I looked it up at Company's House, and it said that the company was formed, I think, in 1990, whereas I had it in my head that it was 1988 or something like that. So, yeah, slightly embarrassing, but there you go.
That's a great story, though. So what's the focus of the company going forward? What's the main area you're looking to expand into?
Yeah, we've built what we call a CCMS, so a content and community management system that we call KIT. And the idea behind KIT is that it brings together a really good content management system and a really good community management system. We used to use, a lot of our clients were using things like vBulletin, again, sort of a good few years ago now. And we found sort of some recurring issues that would come up with that. We had other clients such as Mumsnet who were using custom built, forums software. So that was the kind of forum side. And then on the content side, again, we found customers were either using custom built stuff or they were using Drupal or WordPress, probably more often Drupal. And we found some sort of recurring themes in the difficulties that they were having. And what we came to realize was that most of those systems had been conceived by well-meaning software developers rather than the people who actually kind of run the, you know, or use those systems on a day-to-day basis. We started building, the other thing that we came to realize was that we had a really wide variety of customers coming to us, asking for kind of basically an online community site to be built, although they might not have even realized that it was an online community site. You know, they might not have been thinking of it in those terms, but we were finding that no matter what people were asking us for, there was a lot of commonality. So we tried sort of, you know, using Drupal, say, in a standardized sort of way. But we weren't happy with that, and our customers weren't happy with that. So we started building this KIT platform in Ruby on Rails. We had software originally we were a software development company, so it made sense that we developed something in Rails, and that went pretty well. And we tried to do it based on what we'd learned from Mumsnet and from others who, you know, the frustrations of you know, them actually trying to use the system, sort of things that they needed to do which weren't immediately obvious to us or to anyone who's purely a software developer rather than a user of those systems that they build. I remember back in the 90s, I built some software for a bank, and in the day it wasn't web based, it was actually a Windows application. But I remember one of the functions of this piece of software was that you had to choose the currency of the transaction. And so, being a software developer, I of the day, I thought, well, you know, it's a fixed list of currencies. There'll be about a dozen of them or something. Clearly, it needs a drop-down list box on the screen in order for the person to select the currency that's being used for the transaction, be it US dollars or sterling or French francs or whatever. This was before the euro. So I put it in a drop-down list box. It seemed to be the sensible thing to do. But I ended up working really closely alongside those guys, and I watched them using the system. And this was before anyone had dreamt of, you know, usability testing and, you know, eye tracking software and all that good stuff. So I watched them using the system, and you know, they would type in most of the details of the deal, the amount and the you know, various other things. They would type them in, and then they'd get to the drop down list box, and they'd have to click with them. They'd have to sort of find their mouse on the desk underneath the pile of papers and click and select the currency from this drop down list box. And I said, well, you know, they said, oh, kind of. Actually, we wish we could type it in. And I said, well, you know, let me see you type in the rest of the transaction. And they were doing it all on the number pad on the side of the keyboard, because most of the details of the transaction, the date and the amount and so on, were all figures. So I said, well, how about we make the currency selector, instead of being a drop-down list box, how about we make it so that you can use a number to represent the currency? So one was US dollars, two was British pounds, three was French francs, four was Swiss francs, and so on. Now, to a software developer or even a beginner in kind of usability, you'd think that would be an awful system because you have to remember those codings to know that, you know, one is US dollars and two is British pounds. But of course, if you're typing in 200 of these things every day, you learn them within the first 20 minutes. And after that, it's so much faster to just type in a number than it is to choose something from a drop-down list box or even type in the letters that represent that. So we kind of bring in, that was, as I say, in the early 90s. Bringing that all the way forward to today, we found people were using these systems like Drupal, and they'd be browsing their website or they'd be browsing their forums, and then they'd want to edit something. They'd spot a spelling mistake, or they'd see a spam post that they want to get rid of, or they'd see a user that they wanted to get in touch with, or they'd see something that was happening that they wanted to promote to the top of the page. And in most systems, certainly in those days, you had to sort of go to a separate admin interface, log in as an administrator, then browse back to the thing that it was that you wanted to edit within your admin interface. And then you could choose these options to edit something or promote it or to mark it as spam or whatever you wanted to do. So what we've done with Kit is make everything happen in place. So you're browsing the site, you're looking at the site just the same way a user does. You see something you want to edit, you click on it, and you start typing, and you're editing it. Same with the forum moderation. You're using the forum. You see a post that, you know, needs editing or needs deleting because it's spam or whatever. You know, one click, and that action is conducted. There's no separate admin interface. Even, you know, editing posts, it's all kind of in place. So that was one of the big motivations for Kit and one of the examples that as to why we kind of felt, you know, a new system was needed and that we built. The other big motivation behind it is that we didn't want to do kind of shrink wrap sort of stuff. You know, if you just want a standard forum, then, you know, there's plenty of software out there you can download. But what the service that we really offer is to take someone's specific set of requirements and build additional functionality. But we know that they're going to want the basics of a forum. So Kit provides us the basics, and then it provides a completely open system on which we can build whatever other functionality it is that the user wants. So an example of that is we've got a client who is interested in reviewing sports facilities, and those sports facilities are scattered around sort of geographically. So they want a forum, but they want to kind of embed within the forum this idea of a kind of a geographic kind of element to it.
Like a map with pins and that kind of thing?
Yeah, that kind of thing, but to be fully embedded with the forum so that you can kind of go from map to forum and forum to map, and it all happens kind of automatically. So, you know, when you're talking about a particular location or you're reviewing a particular facility, then, you know, you can see it on the map, you can see how far away it is from you, you can search and filter and all those kind of things. So, you know, that's an example of using the basic forum functionality, but also building something custom on top.
That's neat. Before we get out of here, I got to ask you something I saw on your, you know, obviously before we did this, I checked out your website and stuff, and I saw some of the latest stuff you were blogging about. And something really caught my eye, adaptive websites. Can you, like, talk about that a little bit? Because this is very neat.
Yeah, okay. So the basics of adaptive content are that you adapt the content in some way. Now, most people these days are familiar with responsive content, which is basically whereby the layout of your page responds to the device that you're using. So if you're using a phone, the page reflows itself to fit nicely on the screen of a phone or a tablet or a desktop computer. So that's responding to the device. With adaptive content, you can adapt to a whole bunch of things, not just to the device, although that's one possibility, but most interestingly, I think, to the user in terms of what you know about them. And usually you know more about the user than you actually might at first think, if the system will only expose that information to you. A guy, I can't take credit for this, but a guy that I was working with said, well, it's like if you think of your website as a conversation with a person, when you meet somebody new, you ask them how they're doing, and they say, oh, I'm fine, I'm off to Scotland tomorrow. Then when you see them the next week, you don't say, you know, hi, how are you doing? What, you know, kind of, you pick up from where you left off, right? You say, oh, how was Scotland? Because you know that they went to Scotland last week.
Right.
If it's a business thing, and they come in and they ask about your product, you say, yeah, we've got this product, it's really good because of this. And then the next day they come back, you don't start from scratch again with them. You don't start describing the product from scratch, because you know very well that you spoke to them yesterday and you told them all about your product yesterday. So the basic idea behind adaptive content is to adapt to the user. We list some other examples on the website about adapting to the time of day, adapting to the type of device or the type of internet connection that someone's using. Someone suggested to me that we could charge people more for the products if we know that they're browsing on an iPhone, because rather than an Android phone, because iPhones are more expensive than Android phones.
Oh, that's getting into some sneaky territory right there.
I was going to say, personally, I wouldn't take it that far, but you know, those kind of things are possible. So what we've done on our own website is we've kind of exposed this a bit. We've put this button on the homepage, which allows you to switch on and off what we call the adaptive layer. And what that adaptive layer shows you is some of the ways in which we've subtly modified the page because of what we know about you. So ordinarily that would all be happening behind the scenes. People are most familiar with it in a more basic way, actually, with regard to the advertising industry. You know, when you visit one site and then you visit another site and it's showing you ads for things that you know that it knows you're interested in. So we're adapting not just the ads, but the whole content. So, for example, we might vary the wording of a call to action based on how many times you've been to the page before. We know which pages you've been to. We know whether you've been back to them again subsequently. We know how far down the page you scrolled. We know whether you read to the bottom.
And you know how long you've been on there, which is neat.
Exactly. Yeah, we know how long you've been on there. We know how far down the page you got. So for example, you might say, well, you know, yes, this person went to these five different pages, but they didn't scroll down on any of them. And they didn't spend very long on the page. Clearly they're finding it difficult to, you know, get the content that they're really looking for, because we know these are long pages. And if the person was finding the content they were really looking for, they wouldn't be not scrolling down and they wouldn't be not spending long on the page. So we might bring up something that helps them try to find what it is they're looking for. So those are some examples of adaptive content. And as I say, on our website, we added this feature, which you can toggle on and off to actually see how we've changed the page. Because obviously, ordinarily, all this stuff happens, you know, behind the scenes, and right. People aren't aware of it. So that's adaptive content in a nutshell. And it's one of the things that's kind of baked in right from the start with our content and community management system. So we can adapt what's on the page, both in content pages and in discussion pages, if we choose. And the client can define, you know, different categories of people based on their actions on the site. We measure. Another thing that we do is a lot of sites these days are using tools like Google Analytics and Crazy Egg and Kissmetrics, all these things, and they're all really great in that they can track exactly what people are doing on your website. The downside to them is that they're all after the event. So you install those tools, people use your site, and then you as the owner of the site can go and look at those tools, and they'll tell you what people did, you know, later on in the day. Or sometimes, you know, Google Analytics, obviously real time, you can see what people are doing there and then. But you can't actually take any action action on the basis of that information.
Right.
Because it's not accessible within your forum system or your content management system. So what we do with Kit is we track all that same data, sort of right at the source of it. And that allows when a page is being rendered to actually utilize that data. So we know how long your session has been and we can adapt the content accordingly, right from within the CMS or the community management system.
David, you must promise me that you will use this power only for good.
Yeah, absolutely. With great power comes great responsibility.
Indeed.
So we do. But it's really a question of what clients want to do with it. And people have got it's fairly kind of emerging. So we've got some projects underway now where clients are wanting to do some pretty interesting stuff. But people generally, you know, they like it. Even users like it because it means they're getting stuff that's more relevant. And because we're not an ad agency, we're not trying to sell you anything. So
right, yeah. You're not adapting. I mean, you're not trying to, at least in this context, it's not like a Facebook kind of thing where
it's not a privacy issue.
Right.
It's not, you know, we're not trying to associate, you know, what you do on the website with the person you are in real life or anything like that. We're just trying to make the web page more relevant and more tailored or adapted to you based on the way that you choose to use the website.
You know, you click pink handbags once and you're just down this rabbit hole you can't get out of.
Yeah, well, exactly. And, you know, of course, those things, I mean, it amazes me that obviously online advertising is such a massive, massive thing. And yet, one of the things I find amusing about those targeted ads is you even if you buy the thing, you still end up getting loads of ads for it. So yes. They're not really that sophisticated because, you know, if I'm browsing for a new TV and then I go to Amazon and I buy my new TV and then I go somewhere else, they're still showing me ads for TVs. I'm the last person in the world who you want to try and sell a TV to. I've just bought one.
The worst offender of this is the gaming industry. I play EVE Online pretty heavily. So, of course, I look at a lot of websites that have to do with EVE Online, whether it's third-party tools or whether it's current events, blogs, podcasts. Every time I get ads for EVE Online, I'm already playing. Like, I've been playing for nearly 10 years. There's no more EVE for me to buy. You can't. It's not even like, hey, would you like this book about EVE Online, the game that you play? It's just ads about the game. I'm like, come on, guys, really?
Well, yeah. Although these days I can't log into YouTube without getting a load of promoted Minecraft videos because I've got a 7-year-old son who plays a lot of Minecraft. So he's always logged in as me, and then it means that it ends up. I think YouTube must think that I've got nothing to do all day but sit and watch Minecraft videos. So I know how you feel.
Yeah. All right. So last question. Well, three quick questions in a row, but to close things out. I haven't tried this with any of the member spotlights before, so you'll be my guinea pig on that one. I'd like to play a game called High Low. Are you familiar with it?
Okay. Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, so over the past week, your highest point, your lowest point.
Well, a week. If we're going on a 7-day, you know, in the last seven
yeah,
days,
seven days ago was
my girlfriend's birthday, so that was pretty much a high point. And in fact, we went up Europe's tallest building. I was going to say London's tallest building, but I think it's now actually Europe's tallest building, and had cocktails at midnight. So I suppose you could call that a high point.
I would say so.
In multiple senses of the word.
I see what you did there.
Yeah. So that was a success. Low point. Oh, well, this is something that one once got. Hang out on the internet. I managed to punch my son in the face. we were playing around, and I lifted up my arm, my hand, and he, as I kind of went forward with my hand, he came forward with his face, and the two met. So he got his first sort of punch in the face, age 7.
Oh.
So I'm hoping that he remembers that fondly, and you know, thinks that it's standing him in good stead for the rest of his life, rather than thinking that his dad likes to rough him up. So that'd be my personal low point. Professionally, I think my low point would be that we've been working with a client who is moving from another system, and the company that holds the data, which they're kind of contractually obliged to hand over, is in their system, and they won't sort of provide us with that data very freely. They think somehow that there's a lot of intellectual property wrapped up in the structure of the data. They think that, you know, they can only use some obscure file format and all the rest of it. And it's like pulling teeth, trying to get the data out of them. So that's been a bit of a kind of ongoing low point this week. But I think we may have finally cracked it. So things are looking up for next week.
Oh, good luck with that. It sounds incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, it really is. And you know, it's pretty clear to me on a technical level. They won't let me speak to, or anyone from our company. They won't let us speak to their technical people directly. It's all going through the client. And I'm pretty sure it's just because they feel, you know, that if they tried to pull some of this stuff on a technically minded person, they'd get pretty short shrift. And so they're, you know, I think they're able to charge more if they can make out that it's this big complicated process, when really all we need is a dump of their database and we'd be happy. So, yeah, that's just, you know, an ongoing battle. But hopefully, as I say, we're moving forward, and next week should be good.
What area of community science research do you have your eye on right now?
Well, funnily enough, I was looking at, I saw the piece that's just come up about whether avatars drive greater levels of engagement.
Oh, that was one of mine.
And I found that. Oh, well, that's good. Because Mumsnet, as I've mentioned a couple of times, one of our clients, they're fairly old fashioned, let's say, in a good sense, in that their forums, they don't have avatars, they don't have strap lines, they don't have post counts for users, they don't have ratings, they don't have like buttons, all these kinds of things. And it's a deliberate choice on their part to avoid that kind of stuff. And obviously they've been very successful. And I find it very interesting the extent to which those things either sort of encourage or discourage engagement. In our system, we've got lots of kind of engagement measuring tools and metrics and all that kind of stuff. But what's interesting to me is the effect that those kind of features have on the users. So I find the research along those lines interesting, and that's why the one about avatars was particularly eye-catching for me.
You know, Crystal Chung just posted a little response about that article. You should go in there and do your little forum wizardry thing. I'm sure she'd appreciate it.
Okay, well, maybe I'll take a look. I did look at the thread I think first thing this morning, so maybe I'll go in again this evening and see if I've got anything to add to the conversation.
Yeah. The new button we have to, you know, have people discuss the articles, I think is really cool. I've seen quite a few people starting to use it now, and it's nice because
it's
a little hard. It's frustrating a bit as a content writer on a community site when you're putting articles out and it doesn't look like it's having any, it's not getting into the groundwater, you know, of the discussions on the forums. So this is kind of cool.
No, it is. We had a client who, you know, we added that feature a while back specifically on the basis of a client saying, you know, well, we want people to talk about the content. So can we have a button that starts a thread, and it gets a thread started based on the piece of content. And then obviously it's a two-way link. So on the thread, there's a link to the content, and on the content, there's a link to the thread. And we do quite a bit with sort of semantic analysis. So we try and find those links automatically as well. So if someone starts a conversation and it's about a piece of content that's somewhere else on the site that nobody's necessarily explicitly linked to, we try and link it through analysis, of the actual piece of content, the piece of writing. We try and extract the what a post is about and what an article is about, and see if they match up.
Oh, that's brilliant.
So that's quite an interesting field. Yeah, it's quite cool. There's a lot of there's even there's services out there that'll do sentiment analysis, so they can see whether someone is discussing, not only that someone is discussing a given topic, but whether they're being positive or negative about it. We've got some ideas for how we might be able to use that in the future as well. So yeah, it's there's some great technological advances, I think, that are coming along to this area.
All right, and finally, if Community Geek members want to contact you about Kit or contact you about any of these cutting edge web development things you're working on, what's the best way for them to do that, and what's the best place for them to follow what you're doing?
Well, they can contact me through Community Geek through the site itself, or go to our website, which is www.dsc.net, which is a nice short URL. In fact, you can just go to dsc.net. So that's only what, seven presses of the keyboard.
Yeah, you can tell you've been doing this for 25 years, because there's no way you would get that URL now.
No, I know. It's pretty short. But yeah, there's a contact form there. There's an online chat thing, and you know, we're not just interested in hearing from, people who want to buy our services, although that's great too. You know, we'd be happy to hear from anybody who wants to talk about this stuff.
All right, Dave. Well, thank you very much for being on the spotlight with me. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's been my pleasure.
All right, and thank you guys for listening out there. Please tune in next month for the next one. We're going to continue featuring the most interesting members of Community Geek every month until we run out of members, which, fingers crossed, will be never. So I hope you stick with us. I personally, this is my favorite thing to do for the site, is having these spotlights. They're always fascinating. So definitely join me in for the next one, which should be coming out in November. So thank you very much, and we're out, and you guys have a great month.